Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jesse Zarley, a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Marisol Lebrón about her new book, Policing Life and Death, Race, Violence, and Resistance in Puerto Rico, which was published in 2019 by the University of California Press. Marisol is an assistant professor in the Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her scholarship has appeared in publications such as Radical History Review, Souls, a Journal of Black Politics, Culture, and Society, NACLA Report on the Americas, and the edited volume Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter, published by Verso. She's also actively participated in conversations about Puerto Rico and its diaspora in Truthout and The Guardian, and is one of the co-creators of the Puerto Rico syllabus. Marisol Lebrón, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
So, Marisol, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself. Where did you get your PhD and what brought you to study Puerto Rico?
Yeah, so I got my PhD in American Studies at NYU. And the reason why I got interested in Puerto Rico and particularly in this project, I'm New Yorican, so I'm Puerto Rican, raised in the diaspora. So I have kind of a familial tie to the place. But when I was at NYU, I became really interested in questions of pop culture when I first started my PhD. So the way that I got to this current book project was kind of through some circuitous paths. But when I started my PhD, I really thought I was going to do my dissertation about reggaeton music and kind of representations of race and gender and sexuality in reggaeton music. And so my first year of coursework, I was doing all of this research and had kind of started doing some reading and research on the precursor to reggaeton, which was underground rap music in Puerto Rico. And as I was doing those that set of reading, I kept coming across these discussions about a series of police raids in a number of record stores across, especially the San Juan area in Puerto Rico, where they had confiscated underground rap CDs and mixtapes. They had arrested record store employees. And it seemed like there was this kind of public discourse of an intense police crackdown on it because it was classified as obscene materials, as pornographic materials because of some of the lyrical content. And so as I was doing this research, I saw that a lot of people were tying it to this set of policing measures called Mano Dura Contra el Crimen or Iron Fist Against Crime, which had sent police into public housing in Puerto Rico. And so once I started kind of coming across that, I shifted away from the kind of emphasis on reggaeton music and more onto an emphasis in on policing. And that's where what I ended up focusing my dissertation on. And that's kind of the product that ended up being this book, is an exploration of Manuel Contra el Crimen and its legacies in Puerto Rico, and kind of what that policing measure can tell us about both the colonial relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico, but also kind of local patterns of racial hierarchy and inequality locally in Puerto Rico. So I think in terms of my own training as an American Studies scholar, it really grows out of a kind of desire to do a kind of transnational project. It comes out of a desire to do a project that is really dedicated to rigorous analysis of structural power and inequality. And I think that comes through and hopefully comes through in this book.
Absolutely. That's a really fascinating story that it started about reggaeton and underground hip hop. In that vein, I'm curious if you could talk a little, I'm very, as a scholar, very interested in sources. And I think that turning to the book, many of our listeners in their own work or readings wrestle with the challenges of either using modern state secrets, classified or highly censored government documents, or for earlier colonialists and early modernists, working with coerced testimonies of slaves, indigenous peoples, subaltern groups. In the case of Puerto Rico, and in your book, you write about a subject kind of actively hiding their sources from you in plain sight. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this idea of creating an archive of policing, you know, how you, in your experience, built around what kind of in the U.S. we call the blue wall of silence, but if you could kind of talk about the police as an archival source, but also your personal experiences encountering that as a researcher.
Right. So that's one of the things, as you know, I talk about in the introduction was kind of the intense difficulty I had in actually, you know, doing this research or trying to figure out how to do this research. And I remember as a graduate student, which is one of the things that I think, you know, for listeners out there who are currently graduate students and are feeling really, really stuck with their research or really traumatized by the process of doing the research, I just remember like crying a lot of days while I was in Puerto Rico and trying to do this research, just because it was so incredibly difficult for a number of reasons. So one, as you know, is just the notorious kind of difficulty, which has been pretty well documented, both in terms of U.S. context, but also especially in Latin America and the Caribbean, with the difficulties of studying the police, period. They're obviously a kind of arm of the state that is incredibly concerned with image control, very concerned with maintaining civilian respect for the institution, right? If not necessarily always trust of the institution, but at least a kind of fear and respect of the institution in order to maintain authority. So as a result, they keep a pretty tight lid on a lot of information. And so one of the things that I would find was I had to get really creative in the archive about how I got access to official police documents. One of the reasons why that was specific to my case was the fact that when I started doing this research was I had done some initial work in 2010, but really in 2011 and 12 was when I did the bulk of the research for this project. And in 2011, the U.S. Department of Justice had released a report calling the PRPD, the Puerto Rico Police Department, one of the most violent and corrupt forces under U.S. jurisdiction. And they eventually ended up entering under a consent decree. So because of that, there was an already kind of the systems in place that already kind of kept that information under wraps kind of tightened a great deal. And it was really difficult for me to get access to any kind of official communication or sources. And so one of the things I had to do was try to kind of round robin around some sources. So for instance, not being able to use official police archives, I had to see what I could get in certain other kind of state archives, like the Senate archives or kind of the Junta de Planificación in Puerto Rico, right? So other kind of state archives that had cataloged some of those police documents. The other thing that kind of information lockdown did, which I'm really grateful for actually, is that since I couldn't necessarily talk to police or get a lot of official police information, because of the weariness of talking to outsiders in particular, which I was as somebody who was coming from the U.S., as somebody who was not kind of born and raised in Puerto Rico, and someone who also is very visibly queer, whose Spanish is not necessarily the greatest, right, was that I had to also start to look beyond official police archives. And I think I, in the kind of aftermath of that, became very appreciative of that shift that was kind of forced on me and really horrible when it was happening. But as I was doing the project, one of the things that it did is it really forced me to focus less on what the police tell us about themselves and more on what people who actually experience criminalization and police violence have to say about what the police are actually doing, right? And so that kind of focus for me emerged through various modes of expressive culture. So things like rap music, for instance, became one source that I used, zines, interview data, and media coverage, right? Both in terms of kind of mainstream media, but also alternative media in Puerto Rico. So how were people who were experiencing Mano Dura Contra el Crimen living under it, but then also people who are kind of 20 years later, people who were raised with Mano Dura Contra el Crimen being normalized, how do they think about this kind of culture that it's created, right? Or this kind of normalization of police power that it's created? So I had to get kind of creative with the sources. And I think I would encourage scholars to think about what are the other ways we can tell these stories without necessarily reifying the official discourse. And I think we're seeing that now with the recent controversy over scholars using these kind of FBI files. So for instance, the controversy is happening right now around a historian who's been using FBI files about Martin Luther King, which we know were doctored, right? Which were intended precisely as a tool of harassment and to discredit him, right? So we can't necessarily always trust these sources. And so I think it's not that we throw those sources out or we don't necessarily consult them, but we also look at other ways of telling these stories and in particular try to figure out ways to privilege the voices of those folks who are actually experiencing these forms of state power.
And in reading through the book, I mean, I think the richness of what you accomplished is really, really impressive and inspiring for people. So for people who it can be anything from a misfiled collection of documents to active silencing of documents, that the kind of building alternative, building around sources and thinking differently about official stories, I think was really successful. So I think this is a good jumping off point to turn to the content of the first few chapters and the kind of core of the books, this tough on crime policy under the government of the Commonwealth governor Pedro Rosselló during the 90s, this mano dura contra el crimen, or iron fist against crime. In recounting this history, you develop this idea, or you work on this idea of punitive governance. I was wondering if you could both talk about Rosselló's policies, its origins, and this notion of punitive governance that you discuss.
Yeah. So and I'll just say for kind of listeners, the book is split in two and like kind of two sections. And, you know, the first half of the book really focuses on Mano Dura Contra el Crimen and the Rosselló administration. And the second half focuses on kind of the more recent kind of period and asking kind of how those ideas have become normalized as what policing means and should look like, and the ways that criminalized populations, but also activists, have to negotiate kind of the normalization of Mano Dura Contra el Crimen becoming what it means to police in Puerto Rico. So Mano Dura Contra el Crimen gets credited to Pedro Rosselló, who was the governor in Puerto Rico from 93 to 2000. And he initiates it as kind of a campaign promise to crack down on crime, because during the late 1980s, early 1990s, Puerto Rico had experienced a tremendous kind of spike in crime, and particularly in drug-related crime. And that happens for a variety of reasons, including kind of, tightening of border security that made drugs crossing in ports of Miami or in Mexico more difficult, which made a kind of drug trafficking circuitry in the Caribbean, and particularly in Puerto Rico, much more pronounced than it had been previously. But it also happens because essentially by that time, the political and economic arrangement, the Commonwealth arrangement between the U.S. and Puerto Rico had really started to falter in being able to provide for its citizens, right, any kind of semblance of what we might term a kind of good life, one marked by financial security, stability, opportunities for kind of upward social mobility, all of those kind of signifiers that had been part of what was promised through the colonial relationship, right, or this kind of neo-colonial relationship of the Commonwealth arrangement between Puerto Rico and the U.S. Really had kind of run its course, and economic development had started to falter. And as a result, the informal economy had really expanded during this period and led to a kind of rise in what we would call street crime, right? And so essentially, because of the limitations placed on the local Puerto Rican government as a result of this Commonwealth arrangement, really it's not able to devise its own economic solutions and policies. It's not really able to respond in a complete and full manner to the needs of its citizens. And the U.S. government was not necessarily interested in kind of dealing with the failures of development that had made themselves pronounced during this time period. And so what I argue in the book is that this creates a turn towards a mode of punitive governance, right? So if the political and economic arrangement can't be dealt with in a meaningful way because of the colonial relationship, then what the local Puerto Rican government does, and this happens in its most kind of pronounced way under Rosselló, is that they turn to policing and other modes of kind of punitive power, including prisons, kind of forms of state-sanctioned and non-state sanctioned violence, right, in order to essentially keep those effects of a failed colonial development model in control, or at least to have the appearance that they're doing stuff to keep those effects under control. And so what we see over the course of the 1990s is these efforts to really counter what is a weak state with the image of a strong state present through its security apparatus in people's everyday lives, right? And so this is something that, you know, is not necessarily unique to Puerto Rico. This is something that we see happening in many U.S. cities throughout Latin America, in Europe and other sites around the world, right? This is something that we can argue is endemic to neoliberal capitalism, right, is a kind of rollback of the state and a roll forward or roll out of its security apparatus. But what I would argue is that what makes the kind of case in Puerto Rico unique and worth kind of paying attention to is the way in which it develops in relation to intense colonial failure. And it develops in a kind of specific mode to attend to that kind of colonial crisis that arises as the kind of Commonwealth starts to run out of steam. So that's what I trace in the book, is these attempts to really create this punitive show of force in order to counter the kind of image of a weak state, or the reality of a weak state, really, we could say. And what's interesting to me about that is the ways in which it actually functions through the reproduction and reification of some of the most pernicious inequalities that have long existed in Puerto Rican society, and in particular through targeting the most vulnerable citizens in Puerto Rican society. So Black Puerto Ricans and dark-skinned Puerto Ricans, low-income Puerto Ricans who lived in public housing and other kind of residentially marginalized spaces, queer Puerto Ricans experience kind of the worst forms of state violence under Mano Dura Contra el Crimen and those kind of punitive forms of governance that followed in its wake. They were in a lot of ways pinpointed as the source of insecurity. So it was these poor people who lived in the projects that were the source of all of the problems confronting Puerto Rico. If you didn't feel safe, if you were worried about getting carjacked, if you were worried about the deteriorating state of things, right? Rosselló and other kind of politicians and elites and technocrats pointed to public housing residents and said, those are the people who are responsible. And so what they did as a key component of Mano Dura Contra el Crimen is then send police and military forces in the form of the Puerto Rican National Guard to raid and occupy public housing for days, weeks, and sometimes months at a time in order to show that these people who were supposedly causing the problems in Puerto Rican society, that were the cause of crime, that were the cause of violence, the cause of disorder, were being handled, right? And handled effectively. And so what this does is shift the tension away from colonial crisis onto the shoulders of actually the victims of these profound kind of economic and political catastrophes that were happening in Puerto Rico kind of at the turn of the century.
I was curious if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more. I think your book adds a lot to both challenging and expanding our understanding of neoliberal capitalism, particularly in Latin America, but also globally. I think we often think of, you know, enclosure, kind of restarting primitive accumulations, taking place often in the countryside, over energy politics, pipelines, the water wars in Bolivia, for instance. But I think that what you show that's so interesting is, on the one hand, on the money side, the gutting of public services is not just going to nothing, it's being directly invested in police militarization, but also the particular spatialization of policing and criminality. So you talked just recently about public housing, and later on I'll ask about university campuses, but maybe you could go a little bit more into this this relationship, or what you think about neoliberalism and policing, particularly in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I think this relationship between neoliberalism and policing is a really key one, right? I think one of the things for us to be mindful of is that, you know, we don't want to necessarily exceptionalize like policing as intrinsically tied to neoliberalism in some way that's new, right? We can think about policing as always kind of related to the protection and maintenance of capital, right? And so there are new ways in which that starts to kind of develop, or new ways that looks under neoliberal capitalism. So some of the things that we see in Latin America and they also kind of are things that are also happening in Puerto Rico, right, is kind of an enclosure of public space, right? So thinking about, we start, you know, these classic kind of texts in Latin American studies. So thinking about, you know, City of Walls, right, in Brazil, and the kind of all of the great literature around gating, right, and talk of fear and crime, right? These are in many ways not just kind of books that tell us something about a kind of transition to democracy, right? But they also tell something really important about neoliberalism, right? And in particular, as the state starts to retreat as part of these kind of neoliberal doctrines, right, of less state financing, more private accumulation, there's a kind of increase in citizens' feelings of being under siege, of being not protected by the state, right? And these calls for a stronger kind of state to deal with crime, right? And then, you know, for me, one of the interesting things that I saw in the case of Puerto Rico, right, that kind of was a little bit different than how we saw these connections between both a kind of neoliberal policing that has to do with enclosure, but also one that has to do with kind of resource extraction, right? So what we would see in terms of kind of privatization efforts, or in the case of, you know, a place like Ferguson, right, like fees, right? So like kind of fee extraction. One of the things that made Puerto Rico a little bit different from the kind of US and Latin American cases, but it's embedded within that circuitry, is that because of its kind of unique colonial status, it gets kind of, it promotes itself, right? And this is something I talk about in the second chapter of the book. It's as a way to deal with this kind of declining colonial significance to the US, it starts to tout itself to the US as a kind of innovator of new forms of policing to deal with these unique crises facing kind of the Americas at the close of the century, right, in the 1990s. And it in particular tries to promote itself as a kind of bridge between the Americas, between North America and South America, as uniquely posed to do that precisely because of its colonial history, right? And so essentially, Rosselló and his administration, you know, say to Clinton, particularly in thinking about this as the moment of the NAFTA agreement, right? And this turn towards the kind of South, right, as this kind of neoliberal laboratory, we could say. Rosselló sees this as a moment to kind of cement Puerto Rico's importance to the U.S., right, and to really position itself as a leader in the Caribbean and Latin America. And it says we can show Latin Americans how to effectively police their urban spaces. We can become a model for how they should privatize public housing, how they can turn their kind of military forces or former military forces into effective tools against the war on crime or in the war on drugs, right? And so this kind of becomes this unique moment for Puerto Rico where it's like dwindling significance, right, in the face of NAFTA gets kind of flipped to say, like, actually, you're trying to get into Latin America and we can help you do that, right? And we can help to become essentially this kind of colonial middleman figure that can make, you know, the dream of neoliberalism true, right? So if the dream of free trade and neoliberalism is kind of unencumbered, smooth transits of capital and ideas, right? Then what Puerto Rico was saying was that, particularly in the realms of security, that it could do that. It could provide that for the U.S., right? And so I think that's one of the really key things that I try to focus on in the book, right, is that although we see Puerto Rico fitting into some of these larger kind of trends around neoliberalism, again, its kind of colonial relationship with the U.S. and then also its position in relation to its Latin American neighbors and Caribbean neighbors really gives local elites on the ground in Puerto Rico a kind of different set of motivations for why and how they insert themselves into these emerging and consolidating kind of neoliberal economic orders, right, at this specific time. And the significance of what those kind of economic shifts mean to them are a little bit different from the ground that they're standing on.
In terms of what you just began that answer with this idea of policing and its relation to capital being much older than, you know, the end of the Cold War, I was so struck. You have a quote early on from a government spokesperson in Puerto Rico describing crime as a cancer for which policing was a difficult but necessary medicine. It was such an echo of the rhetoric of the Pinochet dictatorship and anti-communist rhetoric in the previous decades. But you also note that liminal space that Puerto Rico inhabits both as kind of a colonized and continually experiences colonial relationship to the United States, but also being part of Latin America. I was wondering if you might comment a little bit on something that was very surprising for me, was how Puerto Rico did serve as a model for policing of public housing and anti-crime initiatives in both in the U.S., particularly in Washington, D.C. and in New Orleans.
Yeah, so we see it a couple of times in the chapter, in the book, in a couple of chapters. But thinking about kind of what I was just talking about in relation to the second chapter, as Puerto Rico is like kind of trying to negotiate this NAFTA era new reality and its new place in a kind of emerging global order, one of the things it tries to do is precisely present itself as a model for law enforcement and particularly law enforcement of kind of public housing and kind of novel ways of using militarized policing in order to kind of achieve winning the war on drugs, right? And so one of the things that we see, and it's really, I think, an echo of kind of previous ways in which Puerto Rico has been understood, but also utilized under U.S. rule, is that in the 1990s, much like in the 1950s, we start to see technocrats from around the U.S. and around Latin America and the Caribbean begin to make pilgrimages to Puerto Rico to see this kind of, you know, in the 1950s, the miracle of the economic miracle and transformation of Operation Bootstrap, which rapidly industrialized the island, right? And then in the 1990s, we start to see technocrats coming to see its miracle in public housing. So how it had cleaned up public housing and these zones of kind of abandonment and despair and turned them into zones of what they termed empowerment, but did so basically at, you know, the other end of a military rifle, right? And so we start to see in particular two kind of public housing districts really start to take a shine to that model. And really the case of Washington, D.C. becomes the most emblematic, right? They really try to bring Mano Dura style policing to public housing in D.C. and use Puerto Rico as a specific example. So one of the things that we see in 94 is that the mayor of D.C. is basically saying that the city is losing the war on drugs and that she's doing everything she can and more extreme measures need to be taken, right? And she really borrows a page from Governor Rosselló's playbook to say that, like, if we're saying this is a war on drugs, then we need to treat it like a war on drugs. And so she makes a petition to the Clinton administration to ask for National Guard forces to be mobilized and to assist with kind of drug enforcement interdiction efforts, but also to kind of focus their attention in public housing and other kind of low-income communities around the DC area. And she explicitly cites the example of Puerto Rico and the so-called success that they had in transforming their public housing authority into a place where police had complete control over the situation, right? But a lot of this was illusion, right? So Puerto Rico, although it sold itself as a model for how to gain control and reduce crime, what we start to see, and one of the things that I track in the book, is that actually crime increases in a lot of these places where the police are raiding and occupying, right? In particular, homicides increase. The argument that I make in the book as to why homicides increase is due precisely to the pressure that these occupation and raids put on the drug points in terms of aggravating already existing competitions and tensions between rival drug gangs, right? They control various drug points throughout the island. And the police kind of knew that and used that as part of their strategy to actually eradicate the drug trade, right? And so one of the things that at various points throughout the book that I talk about is that there is a kind of tacit acceptance among the police that Mano de Contra Crimen and the pressure that it puts on the drug trade is going to momentarily increase homicides, but those homicides are good, or that increase in homicides is not like a sign of failure, but is good because the people who are actually being killed are drug dealers, right? And so there was this tacit acceptance that these lives were not worth protecting, right? This was not the Puerto Rican public that, you know, politicians were promising to make their lives better, right? But these were the people, you know, going back to the metaphor that you cited, who were seen as a blight and cancer on Puerto Rican society, right? So that was folks who were involved in the informal economy. And then it started to expand out to be anyone who lived in public housing or looked like they might live in public housing because of race and class kind of markers, right? Or spatial markers. And so we start to see that the logics of it mark these citizens as enemies of the state, right? And that's the kind of thing that falls out of that image that gets circulated to places like DC and New Orleans and Chicago and Miami and throughout Latin America, right? We see also during this period that delegations from, in particular, the Costa Rican government come and also are playing with this idea of kind of militarized drug enforcement and public housing privatization, and specifically looking at the case of Puerto Rico to do that. So I think that we see that happening throughout the book, where Puerto Rico becomes this model, but we also see that Puerto Rico is also borrowing strategies and adapting them too. And so you mentioned New Orleans, and one of the things I talk about in the fourth chapter is that Puerto Rico looks to New Orleans as a kind of example for rehabilitating, especially post-Rosselló under the Sila Maria Calderón administration, rehabilitating Puerto Rico's image, right, and regaining civilian trust, precisely because essentially under Rosselló, people had seen the ways in which they totally treated certain lives as disposable, right? And treated certain areas as the locus of kind of insecurity and everything negative in Puerto Rican society, right? And so the Sila Maria Calderón administration tries to rehabilitate the PRPD's image by looking at how New Orleans under Pennington, under Chief Pennington, had tried to rehabilitate their image. But the thing that we see is that they import the so-called Pennington Plan, which really was just a continuation of intense targeted policing of low-income areas, but with more of a kind of PR spin to it. So in a lot of ways, Puerto Rico is like fitting into these kind of international and transnational circuits of kind of police knowledge and technocratic kind of expertise, and borrowing from them, but also contributing to those circuits. So one of the kind of arguments that I make in the book is that we can't just think of this always as a top-down process that's, you know, kind of, you know, U.S. bad, Puerto Rico victim, right? And that all of these policies are coming top-down onto the U.S. or from the U.S. onto Puerto Rico, right? Because of the colonial relationship, that's definitely happening, but that's not the full extent of what's happening in Puerto Rico. And if we think about policing in that way, and policing policies in that way, then we really lose the ways in which local elites and politicians were inserting themselves into this kind of global economy of ideas around policing expertise and attempting to reassert themselves as key players, both in the region, but also in relation to the United States.
To kind of shift gears and get at what you just said about the kind of local elites, and I really appreciated what you said about kind of complicating that relationship between the U.S. and Latin America, where it doesn't just go and do what it wants and people follow suit, that there are elites invested in these projects as well on their own terms. I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about some of the resistance and resilience to these policies, maybe beginning with your chapter on the underground hip-hop and rap movement and culture, and what, as you said earlier, was partly your inspiration to getting to this project in the first place.
Yeah, so I didn't completely drop the underground rap stuff. It did end up in the book, and it's one of the definitely the basis for one of the chapters in the book. But one of the things that we see is that, and I try to really focus on this throughout the book, right, is precisely this idea that, you know, Puerto Ricans, and in particular vulnerable Puerto Ricans, are not just like passive victims of punitive governance, right? That they fought back, they spoke against it, and they resisted in ways that were kind of subtle and more overt throughout the entire history of Mano de Contra Crimen, but also into the present as Mano de Contra Crimen has kind of become, and its outcomes have kind of become normalized within Puerto Rican society as just like necessary byproducts of policing or what it means to police in Puerto Rico. And so we see that like expressive media in particular becomes a key venue for Puerto Ricans to push back, right? And so this is one of the reasons why I think like it's perhaps been difficult for folks to capture the full extent of resistance that was happening among kind of criminalized populations, because it didn't look necessarily always like traditional protests and resistance, right? It's not necessarily that people were going out into the streets and marching or showing up at local elected officials' offices and demanding kind of to speak with them, although that did happen, right? But that was not always what it looked like. And so sometimes it was things that were a little bit more subtle. And so it could just be, you know, speaking out and presenting a counter narrative to the press, right? And so one of the arguments that I make is that it's really important for us to pay attention to the moments when public housing residents and other criminalized kind of populations speak to the media and what they say about their experience of policing, right? Because those become key moments where these folks are actually speaking back against the government, right? And its attempt to paint them as all dangerous, as a kind of completely negative force, or as actually welcoming of these policing measures, right? Because one of the things that the government said was, oh, well, public housing residents actually want us to send the military in, right? Because they're sick of living under the thumb of these drug gangs, right? And so we see that the public housing residents were very strategic and savvy about kind of speaking out against these kind of ideas in the media, right? One of the other things why it's important to look at these moments is also because Puerto Rican society was so incredibly segregated by this time, right? There's a number of kind of activists and cultural critics who will actually refer to this moment as a moment where we see the rise of El Apartheid Boricua, right? Or Puerto Rican apartheid, right? Where the kind of ways in which the security apparatus, both in terms of the private security apparatus, but the state security apparatus, and the rise of gating both of public housing and private kind of more middle class and upper class residences basically created a situation where it was incredibly difficult for folks of different social classes to actually interact with each other, right? And so these communications in the media become a space where Puerto Ricans, vulnerable Puerto Ricans, are actually speaking to their fellow Puerto Ricans and being like, the government is telling you X, Y, Z, but what's really happening is this. Right. And so these become really important spaces. The other kind of examples that I focus on in the book, one of them, for instance, is the Underground Rap chapter. Right. And so in that chapter, one of the things that I talk about is actually the most astute kind of critiques of policing at the time were actually happening by young folks who were involved in the underground rap scene, both as kind of artists and as fans. Right. Because those in both lyrics and kind of also discussions to the media or comments to the media, right? One of the things that they did, underground rappers, was really show how much of a smokescreen Mano de Contra Crimen was, right? And they were like, they called out the fact that like the police made these giant shows. All they did was harass people who were just hanging out and trying to like smoke weed or hang out with their friends, like in public housing or at the drug points or whatever. And that nothing got better, right? And in fact, things got worse for many of the kind of young people who spent their time in public housing, who either worked or were associated with folks who worked in the informal drug points that operated there. So they were kind of really clear on the fact that this was, kind of like a cat and mouse game. Like the police would come, they would do this whole show of force, it would temporarily disrupt the drug points, and then that was it, right? That was kind of the end of it. Nothing got better. The other thing that underground rappers did that was really great also was really try to pierce this facade of police authority. And they did it in ways that were really, really vulgar, really funny, right? And that really upset a lot of people, right? And so that's part of why we see what I was talking about at the beginning of our interview, this focus on underground rap as dangerous and as obscene, had to do precisely with the fact that it was a space where young people, in particular young men who were dark skinned or black, used that space to kind of ridicule punitive governance and call it out and actually offer some kind of different modes of, relationality, and kind of, free time, leisure time, right? So I track those in the book definitely as the moments where kind of expressive culture becomes really key and important, and kind of piercing this kind of official state or official police discourse about what Mano Dura Contra el Crimen's kind of achievements were, or what it was trying to do. The other kind of examples that I focus on in the book, kind of look a little different, right? Because they're looking at kind of what's happening now in terms of how has Mano Dura Contra el Crimen kind of solidified this idea that premature death for certain populations, in particular vulnerable populations, is an acceptable and perhaps even desirable outcome of police work. How is it kind of Mano Dura normalized this idea that public housing and other low-income communities and Black communities or spaces are criminogenic, right? So what I look at is a couple of different examples now where people are trying to negotiate the kind of terrain created by Mano Dura Contra el Crimen, and perhaps in some cases offer a kind of alternative modes, right, for creating community safety and security. So the other chapters, for instance, one of the chapters I follow social media kind of debates around how to deal with crime, and in particular the idea that death is an acceptable outcome for crime. So I look at the case of a publicist and as well as a folk singer, two folks who were killed in Puerto Rico, and the kind of response that their murders created, in particular around the police idea that, like, well, these people who are either deviant because of gender, sexuality, or because they're engaged in the informal economy, they just get what they deserve, right? And so I track a couple of really interesting online debates through social media of people pushing back against that idea, right? And actually making an argument that as a society, it's the responsibility of both the state, but also people, right? Everyday people, to keep each other safe, right? And to create conditions that allow all lives to kind of thrive. And then the kind of book ends with an example of a feminist public health organization in Loíza, which is a low-income, predominantly Black municipality and town outside of the San Juan area. And this public health organization, Taller Salud, and their attempt to actually create essentially community accountability mechanisms to deal with gang violence there, that actually allow them to decenter the police in order to create community safety. The reason why they did this is because when the police came in to deal with kind of gang violence, or to, intervene in the drug trade there, it actually ended up creating more violence and trauma. The police would come and often would be incredibly brutal with residents. They would often express a lot of racial animus towards residents, using racial slurs, all kinds of stuff like that. And they actually were like, the police don't necessarily keep us safe. They don't make us feel safer. And so what we saw them do is actually work with young men who were formerly gang involved and do direct interventions, right? So when violence was likely to occur, right, or was on the verge of kind of happening, they would dispatch these violence interrupters to intervene with these young men in the local gangs or corrillos to kind of create this sense of community safety. And this, again, is a really interesting moment where we see Puerto Rico inserted into a larger kind of circuitry, this time not around police expertise, but around kind of anti-police kind of expertise, because they essentially import the ceasefire model from Chicago, right? That had kind of arisen out of African-American community activism in Chicago for dealing with rampant kind of police abuse, right? That didn't necessarily make communities feel safer. And so I end with that because I think there's a really interesting lesson there for us in terms of not only how communities are actually able, if you give them the resources, to deal with these issues on their own, right? And if you kind of, it's not about creating a security vacuum or anything like that, but it is about stepping back and saying, what are actually the resources that communities want and need when they say that they feel unsafe, right? And what Taller Salud and their Acuerdo de Paz and their ceasefire program did is they actually said, the resources that we need for these young men include jobs, they include education, they include more recreational resources, more training, and they also include just people treating them like their lives matter, right? Like their lives are not completely inconsequential, right? And so it took people who had previously had that experience with being in the local corrillos to really validate those young men's lives, right? And to understand those young men's lives in a way that the police can't. Right. And the police can't provide those kind of resources.
I thought the story of Taller Salud was really incredible and inspiring. And I think an important way to show through the kind of second half of the book that you've just gone over a bit, the difficulty, the kind of life threatening, even day-to-day work of walking the line between resisting things like mano dura and police brutality, but also not accepting the language and rhetoric of criminality, which in your earlier examples, for folks who read the book, in the student strike at the University of Puerto Rico in 2011-2012, in the social media discussions and debates, that it's so easy for those frustrated with the government to accept the idea of criminality as part of resistance rhetoric. And I think at Taller Salud, you really show that the work that they do, there's no kind of easy way or silver bullet to undoing those discourses, the kind of the ideas of race, class, gender, and marginalization that you develop throughout. I wanted to ask you before we leave, I usually ask one final question about your current research, but I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about your work with the Puerto Rico syllabus, because I think that in your teaching and your kind of work as a scholar is another example of those kind of transnational or transcolonial connections that Puerto Rico can be involved in the United States and Latin America.
Yeah, so I am one of the co-creators and project leaders of the Puerto Rico syllabus. And for folks who are listening to this and want to check it out, it's puertoricosyllabus.com. And you can go on social media and do hashtag PR syllabus, and we'll kind of get a whole host of access to some of the kind of posts and articles and debates that have been happening on social media as well. But essentially, it's a project that I'm involved in with a number of other scholars, feminist scholars, who for us, it was really important, were folks who were at a variety of different ranks. So the most senior person, Yarimar Bonilla, is a full professor. I'm an assistant professor. And then we have two grad students who also work with us, right? And one of the things that was really important for us was that this was a kind of woman-led project. It's a feminist project, and it's one that is kind of cross rank, right? And because what we noticed in a lot of the kind of ways in which the debt crisis was framed and who was talking about it was it was incredibly male dominated. It was incredibly rooted in this kind of male expertise and economistic thinking that we found incredibly troubling, because the kind of experiences of the debt we felt were really not being represented, right? They were really kind of boiling down to this, really purely economistic thinking, right? So the experience of kind of marginalized populations, of women, of queer folks were really falling out of what the effects of Puerto Rico's debt crisis were, right? So telling people that Puerto Rico has more than $72 billion in debt, right, doesn't necessarily give us a sense of what that means for people's everyday lives, right? And so rather than getting kind of bogged down in these kind of purely economic kind of frames, we really wanted to highlight like what this meant for people in their everyday lives, right? And in particular, we would focus on women, queer folks, people of color in Puerto Rico, immigrants in Puerto Rico, and also what that meant for the diaspora, right? So all of us are working in the diaspora, have different ties, right? So either we're born and raised in Puerto Rico or we're born in the diaspora. So also thinking about the makeup of kind of who are the project leaders as kind of representative of the kinds of transnational ties, right? And kind of also political commitments, right, that we wanted to see. But essentially what we tried to do with the syllabus was precisely because so much of it is framed in these really complicated, convoluted, economistic ways, was really say, if you knew nothing about the Puerto Rican debt, right, and you were just like, what is going on? What is like this $72 billion? How did it happen? We want to provide a set of kind of tools for people to, you know, essentially dive in and start to understand it, right? And so it's broken up into a number of sections. So you will get a kind of, this is how the debt was generated. This is what the effects are. These are some of the solutions that are being proposed, and kind of get some of that. But you'll also see examples of, in the syllabus, of the incredible resistance to what have been the kind of solutions proposed by both local and federal governments to the debt, in particular the Junta de Control Fiscal, or the Federal Control Board, which is many people feel is a kind of dictatorial, non-democratically elected board that now oversees Puerto Rico's finances. And essentially their primary purpose is to do everything possible to pay back the debt, right, and to service the debt to bondholders, and which has resulted in school closures, and kind of massive cuts to the public good, pensions, all of this kind of stuff, right? So we focus on this kind of resistance, and we focus on kind of some of the more kind of cultural aspects of the kind of ways in which people are speaking out or resisting. But we also try really hard to situate the debt within the colonial context, right? The ongoing colonial context of the relationship between Puerto Rico and the U.S., right? So the debt is not just this thing that happens in, 2005 or 2008 or, 2012 or whatever the kind of moment that people often trace it back to. It's something that we make an argument through the kind of sources that we compile on the syllabus is something that we trace back to 1898, right? And the moment of kind of U.S. occupation of Puerto Rico and the imposition of these colonial structures, right? That create kind of debt bondage that culminates in the debt crisis that we're seeing today.
That's awesome. I look forward to using it in my teaching. So thank you for the work that you've all done on that. So last question, we've taken a lot of your time. Just before you go, what are you working on today? What's your next big project?
Yeah, so I'm really excited. We have a co-edited volume coming out. I have a co-edited volume coming out with Yari Marbonilla called Aftershocks, of Disaster, Puerto Rico Before and After the Storm. And it's coming out with Haymarket in September to mark the second anniversary of Hurricane Maria. And we're really excited. We just got the kind of advanced reader copies the other day. And we compiled over 30 contributors, both from the diaspora, but also from Puerto Rico, to kind of give an understanding not only of what the impact and effects of Hurricane Maria were on Puerto Ricans, but also what the kind of antecedents were, right? And how we can think about and situate the hurricane and what came after as like part of a longer colonial history. So one of the questions we ask, right, is Hurricane Maria itself a kind of aftershock or after effect of the colonial relationship, right? Or is, you know, how can we kind of think about it in this longer kind of relation, right? Because definitely while we can understand it as a natural disaster, right? The way that this, the kind of ways that the infrastructure was weakened and what kind of came after were not necessarily, you know, they were man-made in a lot of ways, and they had deep, long-standing ties to this kind of, to both the Puerto Rican debt crisis, but also this longer kind of colonial history. So we have that coming out in September, and we're really thrilled and excited about that. And then I'm starting kind of the research for my next book project, which is looking at Puerto Rican involvement, international solidarity movements over the course of the 20th century. So moments where Puerto Ricans decided to align, Puerto Rican activists decided to align themselves with kind of international freedom movements. So whether it be kind of the anti-apartheid movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, arguing against the occupation in Palestine, right? And decide to align themselves with these movements in a way that both is about showing solidarity, but that is also about thinking through their relations of domination and militarization and colonialism and extraction in the context of U.S. colonialism through a comparative case, right? And so a lot of times what we see is that activists are really savvy in their alignment with particular international solidarity movements to kind of also make an argument about their own kind of enduring condition of colonialism in a decolonized in a society that imagines itself as kind of decolonized, right? Or a world that imagines itself as post-colonial, right? So that's kind of what I'm working on, and I'm really excited. I'm going to be on sabbatical next year to actually work on this, so it will be really thrilling. So yeah.
Well, enjoy the sabbatical.
Thank you. I'm very
excited. those sound both like really great projects. Maricel, I wanted to thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and take care.
Thank you so much, Jesse. This was great. It's a pleasure.